Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Andrew Azarmi from the Dentons firm on behalf of appellant ehealthline.com or EHL for shorthand. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You may.
There are two orders appealed. First, the district court's order finding that it lacked personal jurisdiction over defendants Farmanyaga Berhad and Modern Industrial Investment Holding Group Company. Second, the district court's order awarding Farmanyaga attorney's fees under the trade secret statutes. I'll address the jurisdiction point first, but I want to emphasize that while I believe the jurisdiction point is a closer call under the case law, I believe the attorney's fees award must be reversed under the applicable law. So I do want to save enough time to address that issue. Appellant EHL does not contend that defendants' contacts with California are sufficiently continuous or systematic as to give rise to general jurisdiction. Rather, it argues that the court has specific jurisdiction because its claims arise out of defendants' contacts with California. The Ninth Circuit has said that whether specific jurisdiction exists is determined by a three-pronged test. The non-resident defendant must purposefully direct his activities or consummate some transaction with the forum or resident thereof, or perform some act by which he purposefully avails himself of the privilege of conducting activities in the forum, thereby invoking the benefits and protections of its law. The
Mr.
second
Azarmi,
prong.
Let me ask this. As I understand, the non-disclosure agreements were negotiated with choice of law provisions away from California to other fora. Either London for arbitration or to Singapore, I believe. Why does that not suggest that the parties did not wish to have California be the forum state for these interactions?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I believe that if that were simply enough, despite the conduct that's alleged at issue, and here we are only at the complaint stage, and so the allegations must be construed in the light most favorable to the appellant for purposes of jurisdiction. But if the forum clause in and of itself were enough to avoid personal jurisdiction in this forum, that would essentially give anyone who had made contacts with the forum a free pass based on a forum clause. And, you know, forum clauses are very common in commercial contracts. And here, I think that it goes beyond simply saying that there was a contract that was negotiated, which had abroad, which had a forum selection clause. I think here the allegations show that there was outreach by the defendants and appellants. For example, there was in-person meetings and there were in-person meetings in the U.S., in California, in Sacramento, at EHL's headquarters. Also, as part of this tripartite agreement, and I don't dispute, Your Honor, you are correct that there is a forum selection clause. I mean, I can see that that is the case. But this contract was negotiated according to the way it's alleged in the complaint. There were negotiations occurring in the United States, in Sacramento. We had in-person meetings. Modern, one of the defendants, had a consultant that was based in Northern California that was working with it.
Can I interrupt for a minute? I don't want to let your time run too much. You say you concede there's a forum selection clause, as you have to. I mean, there it is. Why doesn't this just plain old govern the case, irrespective of contacts? Obviously, someone can contract out of in personam jurisdiction by signing onto a forum selection clause. So why does not the clause control this?
Well, Your Honor, under this court's precedent, you know, in particular, the case Global Commodities Trading Group, which was the Ninth Circuit 2020 case, the site is 972 F3rd 1101. In that case, the court said that you have to actually look at the entire course of conduct, the entire the transaction history between the parties, the course of conduct between the parties, that you don't simply look at one myopic point. And here, I think that if the court were to rule that just this forum selection clause in and of itself would deprive the court of jurisdiction, then any party that enters into a commercial contract with the forum selection clause, is thereby, even if
well,
there
no,
is harm.
Well, no, it depends on what the clause says.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that a clause could be worded to require of a foreign forum, but a defendant can still aim their conduct at the jurisdiction, knowing that the harm will be felt in the home jurisdiction. And
so
here,
Charlie,
I think that's...
What was the nature of the consultant, Ms. O'Neill's role in this? I understand she was employed by a subsidiary of Modern, but do you consider her to have been an agent of Modern itself?
I do, Your Honor, and I do believe that that's how it's alleged in the complaint. And again, an allegation in the complaint on this ground, any factual dispute needs to be construed in favor of the plaintiff asserting jurisdiction. And here, Modern's Ms. O'Neill was an agent because she was sourced to help find an investor who might be interested and might have the knowledge and the information that would support this tripartite agreement, which I acknowledge contemplated construction that would happen abroad, but that Ms. O'Neill worked for Modern and was seeking to find the United States investor to enter into this tripartite agreement, in this tripartite agreement. And that's how Modern came to this tripartite agreement. And Modern was in Sacramento. It was meeting with Farmignaga representatives. It was meeting with EHL at EHL's headquarters. Modern's representative was represented by Ms. O'Neill, its agent, as it's alleged in the complaint. And that occurred at Sacramento in at least two in-person meetings, in addition to the signing of the various agreements here. There's a memorandum of collaboration. There's a non-disclosure agreement that was entered into between the parties. And I see that my time is dissipating. And so I'd like to point out that some of the record sites, which I think support that the defendants directed their contacts, directed their conduct against EHL in California, and that they targeted EHL, are in the record, I believe, at 294 to 302, 306, 308, and 309, and 313 to 317. And I think if you look at those specific allegations, I think that this case, you know, while not on all fours with the court's 2020 decision in global commodities trading, I think there are certainly similarities. And there, the Ninth Circuit, you know, this court said that looking to the place of performance, the court looks to the business reality behind the particular contract at issue, and emphasized that the need for a highly realistic approach that recognizes that a contract is ordinarily, but an intermediate step serving to tie up prior business negotiations with future consequences, which themselves are the real object of the business transaction. And that prior negotiations and contemplated future consequences, along with the terms of the contract, but also the party's actual course of dealing, must all be evaluated in determining whether the defendant purposefully established minimum context with the forum. And that was the court in global commodities trading at 972 F3rd at the Penn site's 1110. But they were referring and citing and discussing the Burger King case from the Supreme Court. And so I think that this case, you know, although again not on all fours, I think most aligns with that case, and that's because there was not only this 2-day in-person meeting in Sacramento, California, at which representatives of both Modern and Farmignaga personally attended, but there was also Ms. O'Neill, Modern's local representative based in California, which was there which acted as a consultant on behalf of Modern and had a California a base, you know, situs. And although the telephones and the emails by themselves perhaps would not support personal jurisdiction, here there were over 50 telephone calls lasting over 75 hours, hundreds of emails in California, which I think combined with the in-person contacts, and the presence of Modern's consultant, Ms. O'Neill, would fit within the court's precedent for personal jurisdiction, particularly, I think, as guided by the global commodities trading case. I'd like to pivot to the attorney's fees issue because I do think it's very important here.
Well, Mr. Ozzie, you are into your rebuttal time. Do you want to continue, or you have 4 minutes left, four and a half?
Yeah, I'll just take two minutes just to outline this. I think it's an important issue. The attorney's fees, I think, here's award should be reversed for two independent reasons. First, it's facially defective. It fails to comply with Rule 54 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Here, the district court signed a proposed order provided by Farmignaga, summarily granting their motion for fees, failing to provide any conclusions of law or findings of fact to support the award. And that I think, violates the plain language of Rule 54, Rule 54D2C, which requires the court to find facts, state conclusions of law, as provided for in Rule 52A. The second point, and then I'm going to stop here. The second point is that I believe that the district court's award is independently flawed because the filing of this complaint against Farmignaga does not come close to supporting the standard, which is objective speciousness of the claim and subjective bad faith in bringing the action. It's Farmignaga's burden to prove both of those prongs, and I don't believe that either of those prongs are fairly met here. There has never been a determination of the merits of this case. The ICC tribunal found a negative jurisdiction finding, and the district court found it did not have jurisdiction over Farmignaga or Mater. There's never been a merits ruling, and in my view, that does not come close to meeting the standard that's required to support attorney's fees on the trade secret statutes, and it would have a chilling effect if the court were to rule that this did. And with that, I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Sameh Degasen for Defendant Farmignaga. Farmignaga is a Malaysian company which was approached by EHL to engage in a joint venture in Saudi Arabia that has absolutely no connection with the United States. All of the alleged trade secrets, contracts, and negotiations in this case center on Saudi Arabia. And far from availing itself of the benefits and protections of U.S. law, Farmignaga did everything it could to structure its affairs away from the United States forum, including, as Your Honor pointed out, by inserting numerous contractual clauses that direct this case away from the U.S. The only connection this case has with the U.S. is the fortuity of the plaintiff's residence, and as this court explained in Morrill, that is not enough. And the only reason this case is in California at all is because EHL filed a retaliatory lawsuit years after the completion of arbitral proceedings in London that definitively resolved all of the underlying trade secrets allegations.
But that's a different argument, right? I mean, you're not arguing res judicata, we're arguing in personam jurisdiction.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, I think it goes to the attorney's fees issue, but just to sort of give you the background of how
I understand the background is important, but that's not the issue. It's the personal jurisdiction.
Yeah, absolutely, Judge Fletcher. I think it is important to note for the purpose of the attorney's fees award that even on appeal, EHL does not dispute that the purpose of this litigation was to extort Farmignaga into giving up a facially valid award. And the district court, who is very familiar with this case and these parties, I think very correctly issued an attorney's fees award on that basis. I'd just like to start on jurisdiction, though, and address a couple of the things we just heard. I think it's very telling that the lead case that they cite is global commodities trading, which is nothing like this case at all, Your Honor. I do think the important principle from global commodities trading is that you do have to analyze the course of dealing between the parties and figure out what the center of gravity of the dispute is. And, of course, in global commodities trading, there was a long, sustained relationship with the United States. You know, I think the language is, but chose a sustained relationship with Global over several years and hundreds of contracts, purchasing millions of dollars of goods to be shipped from the United States. The goods but chose a purchase were graded according to American standards, and inspection certificates were issued in California, but chose a consistently made payments on contracts to Global in California. That is
essentially... Well, Mr. Jacobson, wasn't the joint venture agreement contemplating a continuous, sustained business relationship between the three parties as well? I understand it was aborted, but that was not the intention at the time that the negotiations were occurring.
But a sustained business relationship in Saudi Arabia. Everything about this case was a tripartite agreement in Saudi Arabia to build a manufacturing facility in Saudi Arabia. All of the alleged trade secrets related to Saudi Arabia, all of the negotiations and contracts contemplated Saudi Arabia.
Wait a minute. You say all the trade secrets related to Saudi Arabia? What do you mean by that?
Well, as I understand, the trade secrets here are all things about the Saudi market, the viability of the project, how the project was going to work, all of those sorts of things. So that even the substance of the alleged trade secrets were things that were centered on Saudi Arabia.
But the difficulty I have with that argument is the trade secrets were compiled in California, were they not? This was a California-based company that created this market research and compiled it there, and the allegation is that the trade secrets were misappropriated from California. So why isn't that enough to create more of a connection with the forum state itself and not have it be as fortuitous as you seem to think?
I don't think the trade secrets are in any meaningful sense compiled in California in the sense they don't have a connection to the forum. I mean, they're in EHL's mind as they would be in the mind of any plaintiff, that wherever that plaintiff was, but they weren't things that had to do with information gleaned from California that had any connection to California whatsoever. And then the substance of the trade secrets all had to do with Saudi Arabia. I mean, the complaint is a little bit unclear on exactly the content of the trade secrets. It's described at I think, a kind of confusing level of generality. But all of the actual substance of what EHL was trying to provide was, how is this project going to work in Saudi Arabia? How is it commercially viable? What are the permits you need? What are the markets going to be? And all of this. So everything has to do with Saudi Arabia. And the only connection to California at all is that happens to be where EHL resides. And I think, as this court said in Morrill, that can't be enough. You know, if EHL resided anywhere in the world, it would be true that the trade secrets and negotiations, everything would be exactly the same.
And what of the consultant in the Bay Area, Ms. O'Neill, and her relationship with this as a potential agent of Modern?
Yeah, that's not an allegation as to Modern. We represent only Farmaniaga. And so I honestly haven't thought that much about that specific aspect of the case. I do think, Modern has not appeared in this case.
Think about it now in the context of it's purported to be over a year's worth of negotiations. You have a Bay Area-based consultant as one of the defendants. There's a trip to Sacramento. EHL alleges that in that trip, trade secrets were misappropriated. When you look holistically at all these allegations, doesn't it start to seem more than just a random, fortuitous, and attenuated connection to California?
Well, I think the agent in California, to the extent that's Modern's agent, it doesn't obviously show contact between Farmaniaga. I think, obviously, if you have a presence in the state like that, I think that maybe makes a difference. As to the in-person meeting, I do think there are sort of a couple of things to note about the in-person meeting. The first is, as this court said in Picot and Morrill, a transitory presence within a forum alone is not enough to create personal jurisdiction. This was only a short two-day meeting. It was at EHL's own insistence, and the meeting substantively had nothing to do with California. It all was about Saudi Arabia and the plant in Saudi Arabia.
Well,
and
I think it might have had nothing to do with California, but it had very much to do with the project at issue, and I guess with the allegations of wrongdoing. That is to say, that's what this all comes out of, is this meeting and this relationship.
So I don't think that's true, Your Honor. I think it's important to note that there is no, and as the district court makes this finding, I think at ER 21, which is that EHL did not allege in its complaint that any improprieties or deception occurred at that meeting. And so that meeting is 2 weeks or over 2 weeks before the MOC. And it's basically before any of the wrongful conduct is alleged. And I think if you look at, ER 315 to 317 is probably the place where it describes this most. But the way in which it's really described is, this meeting is basically a sales pitch where EHL really wants, remember, this is EHL initially reached out to Farmaniaga to engage in this tripartite arrangement. And EHL really wants to sell itself and sell its product to Farmaniaga. And it says, please come have this meeting in California. Eventually, because there are already two employees already in the United States, they come for a meeting over the weekend. They're shown this product. EHL alleges that Famayaga is favorably impressed. You know, they think it's great. They reproduce in the complaint an internal email where these two Famayaga employees talk to their higher ups and say, you know, we think we should go ahead with the MOC. We think this is a good product. And then 2 weeks later, they do conclude the MOC. It's only after the MOC is concluded that things allegedly go south. And
well, can I ask, let me interject. As I understood it, the confidentiality agreements preceded the Sacramento meeting. So, as it's alleged, the reason why that meeting took place was because EHL believed it was under the cloak of confidentiality in which it could release its purported trade secrets. Isn't that correct?
That might be true, Your Honor, but the question is, was there any misappropriation of trade secrets or was there any wrongful acquisition of trade secrets? And there wasn't at that point. At that point, EHL was, I mean, there wasn't at any point, but, you know, even if we're taking all of the allegations in the complaint, which, again, we don't have to do, it's a 12B2, and I can get into that as well. But even if you take all the allegations in the complaint as true, what's alleged is that at that point, EHL were just, willingly giving information, essentially to sell themselves to Famayaga. And at that point, Famayaga was fully on board, was interested in the project, was not doing anything wrongful, had not formed any intent to, you know, dupe or steal or anything like that. None of that is alleged at all in the complaint. There's one conclusory allegation that says it's cloaked with deception, but we don't know what that means. And it's clear from their own allegations, you know, that what Famayaga did at that point was then, you know, continue on with the relationship, sign the MOC as a result of that meeting. So at that point, there's no misappropriation, no wrongful conduct. They're just receiving information as part of a business relationship. It's only after the MOC is signed that they allegedly then go and misappropriate the trade secrets in Saudi Arabia. And it all has to do then with Saudi Arabia. It's the only connection with the United States, which is this short two-person meeting, two-day meeting, which I'm not sure is enough in any event, doesn't even involve any of the tortious conduct. Even if it did involve some tortious conduct, though, I think under this court's decision in Morrill, that would not be enough. In Morrill, there was, you know, calls and emails, all of that kind of stuff. There was travel to the jurisdiction. There was even the initiation of legal process. The central allegation there was that it was an abusive process tort based on filing a harassing lawsuit in Arizona. And this court said even that is not necessarily enough because it's only ancillary to what the primary issue was, which was the Nevada litigation. And that sort of goes back, I think, to the line in global commodities trading about how you have to look to the center of gravity of the dispute and analyze it in the context of the entire course of dealing between the parties. This was always an arrangement that had everything to do with Saudi Arabia. You have an entity like Famayaga that structured its affairs to avoid entanglement in the U.S. forum in every single conceivable way. And the only thing the only connection here is the fortuity of the plaintiff's residence. And I guess this two-day meeting, which no tortious activity was alleged to be to have occurred. That, I think, under this court's precedent, and I think under Morrill, is a fortiori not enough. You know, if you look at the briefs in Morrill, it's all the same arguments about the causal effects test and how, you know, the plaintiff's residence is significant and the injury of the plaintiff in the forum and all of that. But that is not enough under this court's precedent and under the sort of post-Walden case law.
Let me go back to global commodities, because in that case, it was agriculture related to an export of agricultural products to, I think, Central America, to Honduras. It was not based on business activities within, I guess, in California itself, but there we found that there were substantial negotiations that were remote, right, and maybe only one or two actual meetings itself in state. But looking holistically at the entire course of the negotiations and the business relationship, personal jurisdiction was found. So why isn't this a more analogous situation to that? Even if there are business relationships that are contemplated in another country, in Saudi Arabia, there's a course of negotiation that's occurring within state and with a California party.
But I think the central thing in global commodities trading, as I sort of described in that quote, is that the business relationship was centered on the United States. So that was an entity that was trying to avail themselves of U.S. markets, and so clearly had a forum connection that was not based on the mere fortuity of where the plaintiff happens to reside. And I think it's very hard to give any meaning to that language in Morrill and in this court's post-Walden cases if in this case it's still, you know, you would still find jurisdiction, because there is really no forum connection at all other than the plaintiff's residence here. And the only, you know, even this meeting, as I said, no tortious activity occurred. But even then, it only occurred in California because that's where EHL happened to reside. You know, all of the, you know, and I think it's a common sense inquiry. I really do think that. And I do think it's, you know, as this court said and as the Supreme Court said in Burger King, it's not meant to be mechanical. You sort of have to look at it in a holistic way. And I do think the sort of central guideposts are look at the course of dealing and try to figure out what is this dispute really about. This dispute is about the misappropriation of trade secrets in Saudi Arabia. This is an entity that has never contemplated any relationship with the U.S., never wants to avail itself of U.S. markets, didn't even want to deposit any funds in the U.S. You know, it's hard to imagine a defendant that tries to do more to avoid entanglement in U.S. law. And I think it ends up being true that if you say that, even if an entity like that is subject to personal jurisdiction, it's hard to imagine companies, you know, wanting to engage in any kind of commerce with a U.S. company, because it's sort of as soon as you even have a little bit of communication, you end up being entangled in U.S. law. And I think the calls and emails aspect, I mean, this court said in Inouye Boone, ordinarily the use of mails, telephone, or other international communications simply do not qualify as purposeful activity invoking the benefits and protections of the forum state. So, and that's a sort of venerable line of cases that goes back over 20 years. So I think it would be a bit of a sea change to say calls and emails are enough. And I think especially in the context of this, where you have far less in-forum activity than in moral.
You have less than 2 minutes. Do you want to turn to the attorney's fees issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think just a quick couple of points to make about that. The first is, I don't think that plaintiffs ultimately dispute in their briefing that this case was brought for an extortionate purpose. You know, they call it tough negotiating, but, you know, this court has said in numerous cases, including, for example, in Fink v. Gomez, that bad faith can be inferred when the...
Wait a minute. You say they do not dispute that it was brought for extortionate purposes?
Well, they do not...
They wanted money, but I'm not sure they would call... They would call extortionate. You
right. They would not use the word extortionate. I think that they would not dispute that they brought this lawsuit because they wanted us to drop the enforcement action. This was brought 2 years after the conclusion of the arbitral proceeding. So it wasn't sort of an independent desire to bring this claim. They brought it only after we sought enforcement, only after they had refused to pay the arbitral judgment, and after threatening in writing that if you don't drop the arbitration enforcement action, we're going to bring this lawsuit. And so, you know, they call that tough negotiating, but, you know, that is subjective bad faith, this court said.
It's pretty difficult to ask us to infer from the record that this is a sham lawsuit without any findings of fact or conclusions of law by the district court, isn't it?
I think that's correct, Your Honor, and obviously one option is just to remand back to the district court for that. I mean, we explained in our briefs the court doesn't have to do that. You know, in fact, in the Swanson v. Levy case, which is the case that they cite on page 15 of their brief, the court says failure to make the necessary findings does not require remand if a complete understanding of the issues may be had without aid of separate findings. We think a complete understanding can be had on these facts, but certainly then I think the appropriate course is obviously to remand. I think it's important to note that the appropriate course in that situation would not be to reverse the finding of attorney's fees because, you know, I think that there is substantial evidence in the record that it was warranted. It's obviously a discretionary decision. There's no reason to think it was an abuse of discretion, but if you think there wasn't proper compliance with Rule 54, then I think the appropriate course would be to remand.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, EHL is not in Saudi Arabia. Its trade secrets were housed and solicited in California, not Saudi Arabia. Negotiations occurred in Sacramento. Farmanyaga is not in Saudi Arabia. They knew EHL was in Sacramento. They flew representatives personally to California to meet with EHL at its Sacramento headquarters. Modern had its consultant based in California. And the complaint alleges an ongoing lengthy negotiation.
Does it make a difference that the Farmigiano representatives came at the invitation or maybe even insistence of EHL? I mean, they did not come and solicit your business. They came because you were soliciting and asked them to come. Does that make a difference?
Well, I think that if you look at global commodities, the answer to your question, Your Honor, is I think it's a relevant consideration, but I think that you have to look at the entire course of dealing. In global commodities, the business was to occur in Honduras, but the court emphasized, for example, payment occurred in the United States and that there was a course of dealing. And where did Farmanyaga and Modern believe that payment would occur? They entered into non-disclosure agreements in an MOC under which confidential information would be exchanged. Where did they think the confidential information that EHL had was coming from? I think that the fact that EHL might have been involved in a negotiation that in part included negotiations in a course of dealing contemplated in the United States does not by itself mean that they therefore do not have personal jurisdiction if they have their trade secrets misappropriated from them, which is what it's alleged in the complaint. And then just very briefly, I'll respond on the attorney's fees point. I think there's the quotes use extortionate purpose. No, EHL does not concede that. And I think perhaps had there been some merits-based finding against EHL, and yet EHL, in other words, its claim for trade secrets misappropriation had been denied on the merits, and it had nonetheless prosecuted a lawsuit in the hope of somehow having leverage, maybe then you could say that. But that has not occurred. There's never been a merits-based finding that goes outside of just jurisdiction.
Well, there's never
on this
been a
case.
Merits-based finding in this suit. You had a merits-based finding in the London arbitration, in which the arbitrators were actually really scathing as to the behavior of your clients.
But the ruling was that they did not have jurisdiction to decide contract claims or the trade secrets claim. And with that, your justices, your honors, I'll submit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will call our next case.